Those of you who have come more than once notice that our altar is different today. This is the time of year when the birthday of Sri Krishna is celebrated. And even though on our permanent altar, Krishna is represented by Babaji, who is the face at the top of the cross there, Babaji is a more current incarnation of Krishna. In our prayer, we say Babaji Krishna. That's how Yogananda described it. But all of the wonderful devotion and celebration engendered by the incarnation Krishna is too much for us to resist. Plus, of course, it's perfectly appropriate. So this last weekend, on Friday night, we celebrated Krishna's birthday and just couldn't bring ourselves to take it down. So enjoy the beauty of it. And our reading today, in just, you know, a paragraph there, Swamiji is talking about the whole process of how we come into material manifestation and then how we find God, the ego first trapped in lower physical forms, then gradually manifests in the ego, is a necessary element in our self-realization, but ultimately it has to be left behind. That one paragraph is really literally eons of our time. We can spend a really long time trying to sort that out. So we'll at least spend a few minutes on it right now in the hope that in some way it can help unravel this. I was speaking at Spiritual Renewal Week, which is an annual gathering that Ananda Worldwide has at Ananda Village. Ananda Village is our first Ananda community. It's about 4 hours from here in the Sierra Nevada foothills. And every year for almost 50 years, we've been having this program. I was speaking there this year, as I often do. It's an outdoor amphitheater, summer weather. And for some reason, about four flies decided that they wanted to enjoy what I was saying or interrupt it. I'm giving them the positive focus. Four flies wanted to enjoy the experience very up close and personal. And when I glanced at the video of it later, I was curious how it looked. You couldn't even actually see them, but I could see them. I was intensely aware of them like this and doing my best to just keep going through it, but finally it was more than I could do. And they sort of, three of the four of them landed on this little stand next to me. And I just sort of stopped to contemplate them for a moment, thinking, and I said into the microphone, you know, these flies seem to want to be here with me. And then I sort of looked at them and I said, well, I guess we can do this together, you know. And it was for me it was a very actual personal experience. There were three little flies sitting there. They seemed to want to be part of it. I moved my hands a lot. Maybe they could just fly around, you know. After that, they never bothered me at all. They just disappeared. They never came back again. I think I was having a good connection with them and that was enough. Anandamoyi Ma, who was a great saint who lived in, she died in 1982. She lived in India. Once there was a fly that just persistently kept landing on her head and they kept shooing it away. And finally she said, this fly is a great saint from a previous lifetime who just wanted to be close to this body. That's how she always referred to herself. She didn't have enough ego consciousness to use the word I. She was aware that she was inhabiting this body, so she would refer to it. But she said, it's a great saint from a past life. He just wanted to be close to this body. Just leave him alone. So she just let him sit on her head for the period of time. You know, the lifespan of a fly is very short. Ramana Maharshi, who was also another great yogi, there was a cow in his ashram. The cow was called Lakshmi. People speak of the Indian people worshiping the cow, but they don't worship the cow in the sense of imagining that it has supernatural powers to give them. Swamiji puts it very simply. The relation of Indians to cows is exactly like Americans to dogs. Some people think that we worship our dogs, but we don't worship our dogs. We just like them, and we treat them as members of the family. A cow actually has more to contribute. Well, I know I'm going to get a whole lot of emails if I say that. So let me just withdraw that one, okay? A cow gives milk and actually literally physically sustains a family. So the gratitude that a family would feel toward its cow How's that? Okay. It's the same gratitude an American feels toward his puppy, all right? Swamiji, just to go on about puppies and cows, says that the reason Americans put dogs so much in the center of their lives is because the American temperament is very much like a dog. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's always eager. It's always excited. It's always sort of rushing around doing things, you know? And the Indian temperament is much more placid, you know, and just sort of contemplative. And each are different. If you travel around and you see groups of Indians in India and one American, despite, even if you didn't have the physical clues, which you usually have, you would know which one was the American. You know, that's the best about us. It is the best about us. We're just totally enthusiastic and ready. When Yogananda said when he came to America and he started talking about God realization, because we have no tradition in this country, had no tradition of understanding what this meant, you know, in the Indian culture where it's been part of the culture for thousands and thousands of years, people understand this is a big project. In America, it was like, realize God, sure, we can do it, just like that. And he loved that spirit. It was a great joy to talk to people who said, okay, infinity, why not? You know, we can conquer everything else. And for that reason, in fact, you know, Americans can become very great yogis because we don't have this defeated sense of this is going to take a long time. Well, I was starting to speak about Ramana Maharshi and his cow, and the cow's name was Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the goddess of wealth, so the cow was very giving. And this cow was extremely devoted to the guru. And he would come into the satsangs and just try to be close. And Ramana Maharshi said that by that cow's devotion to him and by his capacity to therefore uplift that cow, that was able to skip the entire human level. And they have what's called a Mahasamadhi Mandir. Mahasamadhi is a great yogi's final conscious exit into the infinite. It's when you're self-realized, you have a Mahasamadhi. And the Mahasamadhi Mandir is a little temple where a great saint is buried. Anandamoyi Ma, there's a Mahasamadhi Mandir in Hardwar for her, and Ramana Maharshi has one there in his ashram. And there's one also for Lakshmi, the cow. Now, I have no reason to doubt the story, but the mind does just sort of reel a little bit. Swami Kriyananda remarked once to me that he says when he just looks at all sentient creatures, you know, dogs, cats, cows, people, he said, they all look essentially the same to him. Now, I mean, I need to finish my sentence before that one just stands too long. They all look essentially the same to him because all of them, all of us, we're just on this spectrum between ego identification and self-realization. And it's just a spectrum. You know, obviously human beings have more self-awareness. They have a more highly developed ego, in the positive sense, because what the ego gives us is self-awareness. Those flies, you know, even though we were having a nice moment together, did not have a lot of self-awareness. They were not able to sit there on that little stand and contemplate the fact that, wow, we've been doing Spiritual Renewal Week for 42 years, and here she is talking, and even though we like to be with her, flying around her face is driving her crazy. They just didn't have the self-awareness to do that. There were flies, whatever flies were looking for, they thought they were going to find it in me. And so they wanted to be there. But then they just went off and, you know, found some dead leaves or something, and it was pretty much all the same to them. You know, it's not very flattering to me, but it was pretty much all the same to them because they just have a very instinctual sense of themselves. But they do have a sense of themselves. You know, there's that transition zone when we come into some degree of self-awareness. Swamiji made the statement once that crystals are sort of the transition zone from unconscious matter to conscious matter. Years ago, Swamiji was in Paris, and they had for a long time there a display of huge crystals. Unfortunately, by the time we got to that city, they weren't having it anymore. But big crystals, you know, crystals almost as big as a person. And he said it was in that exhibit, he was very much aware that he was in the presence of conscious beings, but their consciousness was very, very different than human consciousness. But still, there was a consciousness there. That's why jewels have so much power. That's why kings would wear jewels. They have astrological significance because there's a relationship between certain gemstones and certain planets. These are lots of different discussions that we're not going to get into right now. We'll just sort of let that one float out there for a little bit. And that's among the reasons why kings would wear, in higher ages especially, would have and wear certain gemstones when there was an understanding of the universe as an integrated whole. You would harmonize yourself with the natural forces by using those things which would help transition. Even the hands that I'm waving are wearing two gemstones, which I wear because of my horoscope. You know, not for jewelry, but because of the energy they give us. In fact, Paramhansa Yogananda said he was William the Conqueror in a previous incarnation. There's a book called Two Souls, Four Lives, which is in our bookstore behind this building. I highly recommend that book if you haven't read it. It's about both Swami Kriyananda and Paramhansa Yogananda in the life of William the Conqueror and his son, who was Swami Kriyananda. But Swamiji said he was looking at a picture of William's crown. And of course, as William the Conqueror, the King of England, he couldn't really talk about astrology in the same way he could when he was Arjuna in India. But Swami looked at his crown and he realized that it was a Navratna. It was nine gems representing each one of the planets. And that he could see that Master had sort of brought over that knowledge and made his king's crown with that power. That's why gemstones are so valuable, is because they actually give you energy. Okay, that there's a tremendous process going on in this universe that we hardly know anything about. We're moving into a higher age, and this knowledge is beginning to become widespread again. It was known in higher ages. The planet went down in the yugas. Ah, there's another book back in the bookstore recently published called The Yugas, which will tell you all about this, which is also fascinating. Two books you need before you leave here today. Okay? Well, actually, now that I think about it, there's a whole lot more back there, but let's just leave it at that point. Now, the end of all of this, which is the beginning of all of this, which is what I was talking about, is the process of being a human being is part of a much bigger process. And this is the process of the divine having manifested this multitudinous universe. And I'm not just going to skip the question of why he did that, but it happened. And we are bubbles in this great ocean of spirit. And we, all sentient creatures, are seeking to merge back into the ocean. Someone asked me once, when do we begin to seek God? And the answer I gave, which I've repeated here, and I'll say again, when does a river begin to seek the ocean? As soon as there is the river, it begins to flow back to the sea. And that's just a fact of the way creation is, and that's a symbol, literally, of as soon as we are separated from spirit, there's a call within us that wants us, that wants to go back. Yesterday I was giving a class on death, grief, and dying, and I was talking about the fact that The reason we rebel against suffering is that in some part of ourselves, if it's even deeper than conscious, deeper than we ourselves know, we know that suffering is not our inevitable destiny. I was saying, I don't suffer because I'm not an elephant. You know, I don't sort of sit around and just wish I could be an elephant. Oh, if I only had a long trunk like that and could reach out and eat peanuts. You know, it's not like this definite subconscious longing of mine to be an elephant, because I have no intuitive knowledge that being an elephant is what I'm destined to be. But from my earliest memories, I had this deep-seated resistance to the idea that I had to be unhappy, even though many things would happen to make me unhappy. And I could look out in this world and see many causes for profound unhappiness, not only for myself, but for many others. And then out of compassion for them, there would be this impulse, you know, how dare I be happy if so many people are suffering? But deep within us, there's this inner rebellion against that. We know that somehow or another, even though I can't quite figure it out, I'm supposed to be happy. And that's how the bubble's desire to merge with the ocean exists within us. And first we think of it as happiness, we think of it as even below happiness, we think it of pleasure. Before that, we even think of it as survival. But there's always this impulse that I have a destiny, and that destiny is a positive one, and if it's not working out, there's something wrong here that I need to sort out. And we are manifested into these physical forms, you know, from the lowest beings. Yogananda said, speaking of the crystals, that he remembers his incarnations back to the level of himself, the jiva, as it's called, his individual bubble, back to the level of being a diamond. That merging, coming out of unconsciousness into consciousness, he remembers being a diamond. I know, someone had me ask Swami Kriyananda the question, well, how long does it take to get out of being a diamond? And sort of like, how do you get out of being a diamond? And what do you become next? You know, an emerald? A redwood tree? I mean, like, where do you go? Swami just stared at me with that question, and he just sort of said, what a useless question. I said, well, I thought it was very interesting, sir. He says, yes, but it's just intellectual entertainment. He said, the question is, what do I do today? You know, we entertain ourselves with questions that we think are important, and with all due respect, often they're just saying, if God will just answer this question, then I'll get on with the work at hand, which is a very convenient way, knowing he's not going to answer those questions, that we don't have to get on with the work at hand, because the work at hand is what's causing me to suffer and how can I get out of it. And so we manifest physical bodies all the way from the tiniest whatever they are in accordance with the capacity of our bubbles, self-awareness, the capacity of its consciousness. And what makes the human being the highest species, and I know there's a lot of desire to sort of equalize species. You know, who's to say that the human being is more advanced than the dolphin or the whales because they don't make war on each other? And, you know, lots of really good points that you can make. But the masters say, the tradition of Sanatana Dharma, of the eternal religion, says that what makes the human being the highest species is not because he's the nicest species by any means, but because our nervous system, this physical body, is very subtle and it has the capacity to perceive infinity. It has a capacity for an ever-expanding awareness until it can perceive infinity. That's why when a self-realized master incarnates, he incarnates in a human body, because he can maintain his infinite consciousness while in a human body. And yes, there are traditions occasionally of avatars taking an animal body for one reason or another, but I don't know how true those are. I'll just leave it at that. I can't verify that. I can't verify any of this, but it's not, I mean, from my own experience, this is what I understand to be true. But the human body has this level, this infinite capacity for awareness, and I can verify that, as I'm sure all of you can, by the fact that we are able to keep learning. There's no point at which our capacity, our physical capacity, let me how to say this, the capacity of our consciousness to expand ever stops. Sometimes the brain gets tired, but the consciousness is not can still go on expanding even in this physical body. We have this ability to just keep on learning. You know, even when my father, when I watched him in the last 2 years of his life, he had some kind of a stroke, some kind of a deprivation to his brain. Maybe he had Alzheimer's, I don't really know. But he gradually lost the ability to have comprehensible speech. He couldn't remember, you know, vast sections of his life. In a most pleasant way, he forgot the things that he used to be uptight about. And so his just pure sweetness began to develop. And on one hand, from an intellectual point of view, he had been a brilliant man. And all of that was really taken away. But in a very interesting way, watching him, I could see that his consciousness, his awareness, although limited, was also greater. You know, he was still learning. People often ask me, what are people learning when their brains are gone? Swami Kriyananda spoke to me about this because a very advanced disciple of Yogananda, Kamala Silva, she wrote a book called The Flawless Mirror. She was a direct disciple of Yogananda. At the end of her life, she lost all of the normal intellectual functionings of a human person. And when I heard about that, I said, Swamiji, you know, she's lost her mind. And he looked at me and he said, Asha, it's just her mind. And I said, it's her mind. And he said, it's just her mind. And I couldn't get myself around that until I met her. And she had lost her mind. She was still at that point capable enough to say, tell me your name, I'll immediately forget it, but give it to me anyway. You know, like that. But she had only lost her mind. Her heart and her consciousness and her attunement with the infinite was, in a sense, more intact than ever, because it wasn't distracted anymore by her mind. Just as my father's sweetness was more intact than ever because he couldn't remember all the things he used to worry about. He'd been very Virgo and he was always picking things apart, and he just forgot to do that. And all that was left was this childlike acceptance. Now, of course, we can't really make our whole life that way, although some people are asked to do that. They're given brains that don't work, and they're asked to be children for an entire incarnation, and they get to decide on a much purer level whether they're going to have good consciousness or not. Now, as I was starting to say earlier, when we go through all the animal levels, and animals do that, they just have a form that allows them to express as much awareness as that particular jiva has developed. You know, and those little flies had gotten to a certain point, and a lizard had gotten to a certain point, and your little puppy, who has the good karma to be in association with much more highly advanced people, beings, which is you guys, whoever is the mother and father of those puppies, or cats, or whatever they have to do. I have to speak about cats, or else I'll get emails. Cats, you know, or whatever it is that you have, it's good karma for them to be in association with more advanced beings, but they're meant to be dogs. They're meant to be cats, because that's more advanced than a fly, but still, that nervous system is exactly reflected of their capacity to, for self-awareness. And in an autobiography of a yogi, there's a story that Yogananda tells about his affection for a little fawn when he was running his school, and everybody in the school loved the little fawn, and then the fawn was jeopardized, its life was taken eventually because it was overfed by some of the children. And Yogananda loved that fawn enough that he prayed that it not die. I find it interesting that in Autobiography of a Yogi, which is a very short book, but relatively speaking, I mean, it's just one book, but it's essentially the vanguard of Yogananda's entire incarnation. So everything in there is deliberate. And he goes to the trouble to include a story about the human being's relationship to animals. And he goes so far as to describe himself having a deep attachment for this animal. I just I've never been one who has had pets or raised animals, but I know for many people it's a deep and profound part of your life. And I was very touched by the fact that Master included it in his book, even to the point of not wanting the animal to go. But then the deer came, the soul of the deer, the jiva, which was the deer at that time, came to Yogananda in a dream and said, you're holding me back. You know, even though we have the story of Ramana Maharshi and his cow, Yogananda was not going to liberate that deer. He was not going to give him samadhi. He was just a deer, and he was finished with being a deer. Probably because he'd been in close association with the master, and that had speeded him up a little bit. But the ability for him to progress in awareness was now limited by that deer's body, not aided by it. So he had to shed it. And that's what's going on all the time. That's why nothing in this world lasts. That's why these physical bodies, whether it's the fly or my own body or any of yours or anybody that you know, the jiva doesn't stay in it forever, because it's a vehicle for the expansion of our consciousness. And as we grow in self-awareness, as I was saying, what makes the human beings more advanced is we grow in self-awareness. We can objectively consider our condition. We can say, my happiness or unhappiness is caused by such and such an event. We can reflect upon that. We can reflect upon our own actions. We have sufficient self-awareness to know who we are and what we're doing, and to begin and gradually to fully cognize the effect of our own actions on our state of consciousness. And then we have willpower that allows us to exercise a deliberate decision about which way our consciousness is going to go. And every body is useful to us as long as we can keep using it to expand our awareness. And at a certain point, either because the physical vehicle is so broken, you know, that the brain's not working anymore, or we just can't lift it off the bed and walk around with it, or something else has happened to it, but we keep our physical bodies to the second as long as they serve our expanding consciousness. And some bodies, children will keep them for a month or a couple of years or 10 years, and then it's finished. It may not be finished from our point of view, but it's finished from the internal force that's animating that. Because these bodies have no reality once the animating force has gone away from it. Just like you see a dead squirrel on the road or a dead bird, if you've ever seen a dead human body, it's just so nothing. It's startling how nothing it is. And it's startling how exact that moment is when the animating consciousness goes away from it. People I know who have held their pets in their arms when they've died or sat with someone when they've died, it's just like it's alive and then it's not. You know? And it's a wonderful way to live in your body and to enjoy it. You know, it's a nice thing. As one of my friends was saying to a crowd of younger people, he said, enjoy those bodies while they're still so attractive and they work so well. You know, because it's not going to last, believe me. You know, we can keep them dynamic by following the rules of health and meditation and energization, yoga, all of that. You know, right living, right eating, right action, right thought. All of that keeps it more dynamic. But it's just something we're using. It's not an end in itself. And that's why even when the mind is gone, oh, Asha, it's just the mind. Kamala, to the end of her life, remained absolutely sweet. Even though at the end of her life, she'd always loved animals. She had stuffed animals when she was at the end of her life, and she was certain that she thought they were all had consciousness of their own. And who's to say that they didn't? You know, for her, they did. They were symbols. They were symbols of the whole universe, and she just loved it. She was in this, rather, toward the end, she was in this seemingly quite unattractive care facility, and she just thought it was beautiful. She thought the view out her window, which was of a parking lot, was beautiful. You know, who's to say? Who had more consciousness? Those of us who thought, what an ugly view, and she who thought everything that she perceived with her eyes was an exquisite example of God's loving presence. Like, who really had a good brain, who didn't? It's really like a good question, isn't it? You know? The only reason that we're in these bodies, the only reason that we're born, when we bless the children, which we did a couple of weeks ago, we had a ceremony for some of the newbies. It's a couple of newbies to this planet, you know? And the affirmation we offered was from the parents to the child, you know, use your physical body for its purpose, which is to realize God. And then the parent praying, and may I always assist you in that single and only goal. Everything else is a means to an end. You know, all the karma that God gives us, all that we have to do in this world, we have to do it, we're compelled to do it. But it's all a means to an end. Expanding our consciousness. When we do that, nothing else matters. We're doing what God sent us here to do, and the reward for that is bliss. Bless you.